First comes the disclaimer. Because I'm talking about working with desire does not mean that I have been fabulously successful in that project. But it means that I've had a lot of experience with it. I could tell a personal anecdote here, but I guess maybe I'll tell the anecdote after the tape is turned off. All week we're going to be talking about the desire world and the desire body. And as the week wears on, tonight will be very, very broad. And as the week wears on, we will get more and more specific. And the final talk will be exclusively practical things learned in the trenches as taken from large ideas. Tonight we're going to talk about the place and purpose of desire in the spiritual worlds and in our life. That's it. The whole talk is the title. It's long enough. The ideas and the philosophy that we are given by the mystery school, especially the Rosicrucian Mystery School, is really wonderful. And one of the most wonderful parts of it is the description of what a human really is. Because there are a lot of misunderstandings about what a human really is. And the Rosicrucian philosophy, of anything that I've ever looked at, describes that much better than anything else I've encountered. Let's look at some views that aren't it, just so we get an idea of what we're talking about. Because we are in a world that is very materialistic, let's talk about material science and its view of what a human is. And that view is pretty sophisticated. It's very complicated. It's extremely detailed. But it's not very satisfying, because philosophically, it is nonsensically futile. It has determinism and randomness at the same time. Everything starts by a random act. After the random act, everything else is determined, which is really not a very satisfying outlook at all. That's because of materialism. To a materialist, this is all there is. There's nothing more than matter. Even our consciousness, it's fascinating, the theories of consciousness that materialists have. Like for what they think consciousness is, like a material physiologist believes that consciousness is an endless loop in the nervous system, and that it just keeps cycling over again, not necessarily the same path, otherwise our consciousness would be the same all the time. But what they consider consciousness to be is a result of the interactions of matter, which makes it kind of hard to describe logic and meaning, because if you had a different breakfast, your truth would be something different. It's that kind of a thing. And they hope it's a non-defensible position, because they expect that when they make their argument from the materialistic point of view, that you have to believe it, which you can't possibly do, because there is no meaning to it, because your feeling of the belief of truth of something is just another chemical interaction, and it doesn't have anything to do with an objective truth altogether. Obviously, with this point of view, what we call freedom is just an illusion. It's produced by matter again. And all of our attempts to free ourselves and to live creatively are foolish to them. Like, this is, well, enjoy the things of the world because, you know, that's matter and that's it. All of the patterns and the purposefulness of the creation that we see around us, it's because that's just the way matter is. There is no higher wisdom, no higher guidance behind it. So it's an absurd and it's a nonsensical kind of view. It has both extremes, randomness and determinism. Mysticism, on the other hand, ta-da, ta-da! Mysticism, on the other hand, sees meaningful purpose everywhere. And it sees true creativity on every level of nature. Even the dullest, darkest creatures have some degree of creativity. And not only that, we are part of the universal truth more. We are foci of the truth. There's experiments. There are creative acts that we don't know the outcome of, but we are part of the creator and the creative activity that goes through all of these things. It teaches how we can experience and know the truth of everything for ourselves, if we live it out. And what alchemists call the great experiment. The great experiment, we're trying to find the truth within us and to see whether we can unite with the divine within. So that roughly gives you an idea of the two extreme approaches to reality, one being completely outward and material, one being much more inward and spiritual in its outlook. It doesn't pay to go much further on that. You can spend hours and hours talking about those things, but you have a rough idea of things. Let's look a little bit more then at the way that the mysteries look at reality and eventually get ourselves to that part of reality that is desired. Now, there's an irony that comes up from the early days of mysticism when we were more attuned to the inner worlds than the outer worlds. In fact, we didn't even want to come into this world because it was so limited. More of our experience was inward, and we felt more comfortable with that. It was one step closer to the spiritual source. At that time, we had, because we were still very, very receptive, uncontrollably receptive, we had a kind of a clairvoyance, even as early human beings. It was a very negative, involuntary kind of clairvoyance. And with that, we knew involuntary. Yes, involuntary. No choice about it. And with that clairvoyance, because it was closer to the spiritual source of things, we sensed the truth from the source and the purpose from the source. And because we hadn't really much evolutionary experience with the outer physical world, it was kind of foreign to us. The Bible tells us that the only time we knew it was in extreme sensation. That was in copulation. It said Adam knew Eve, and she bore her children. It was the only time we knew that there was somebody outside was in that extreme sensation that we could feel someone outside. Sort of the other way around now. We don't often realize that there's a spirit inside, except in the really extreme feeling of sexuality when somebody else is emoting very strongly. You feel them inside. So it's sort of like the opposite way around now. But for people who were eschewing the coming into matter, the whole quality of the physical world was seen as illusion. And it's really interesting because now that we're deeply involved in matter and we like this world so much, if you go to a psychiatrist, for example, you start talking about inner worlds, you say, that's illusion and it's not reality. So we're very much in a reversed state from the way things used to be. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy is synthetic. In some ways, it has taken the best of both outlooks. It has taken the empiricism and sticking with facts from the material science, and it has taken the ability to home in on the source of all things from mysticism, and it's come up with a really good view of things. And in the Rosicrucian philosophy, we don't say that the material world is illusion. It's a world that is filled with illusory conditions, and it's filled with all kinds of limitations. You can only look at an object with your eyes from one point of view at a time. It's limited, but it is a reality. It is an important reality. It is the reality that is most ripe right now in our evolutionary development. And it also teaches that our experience here, especially the objectivity that we learn in limitation, I learned objectivity the hard way. I've several times walked into lamp posts. It's, you know, those, it goes like that. But the objectivity that we learn here, when we expand our consciousness as we return to the general spirituality, we will not only take all of the experience and the essence of meaning that we have learned in the great experiment on the macrocosmic level, but we will take back that objectivity. And even our enlightened experiences, our transcendental experiences will have the same kind of objectivity that we experience here in the material world, and that is because everything's getting better. And this isn't just a purposeless activity where we're beating our head against lamp poles or whatever. Ultimately, this chemical subdivision of the physical world, comprised of solids, liquids, and gases, is important. The evolution of our dense physical body that relates to the chemical region of the physical world has its oldest and its longest evolution behind it. And we have very facile physical bodies, even in all this limitation. If you're on the side of a mountain, like in Arizona or someplace like that, and you're looking very carefully, even with only average eyesight, you can see a match lit at 20 miles. That's a great sensitivity. Olfactory sensation is such that we can sense one part in 3 billions with the sense of scent. So we've done a great deal here, and we've learned a lot. We have a wonderful body, and it's a wonderful expression of the spirit. Even in limitation, because it is one spirit that is reproduced analogously on all the different levels, so that we have the hermetic axiom, as above, so below, what has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth, know this and rejoice. That principle of analogy is such that some of the lessons and some of the things that we're learning here in the material world apply even to the deepest and most rare of the spiritual states of things. Sometimes we take it for granted. In our smugness, we all have a lot of ego, and because we are familiar with something by having it around all the time, we think we know it. And we really don't. There are things that we see in the world that the world, if we saw it clearly, are very, very different. But we have the obvious things that are happening in the world, elemental things, earthquakes, running water, wind, fire, things associated with the four elements in the more, in the most elementary kind of way. In general, the physical world seems pretty inert, especially if you, you know, a mountain doesn't change except over many millions of years. There are some changes, but they're very, very, slow changes. When we look around at the elemental forms, and if we look at the world around us, especially in this very nice garden that I worked very hard on, we see that some of the forms in the world around us are different than others. They grow, and they change shape, and they have a vitality that must be protected. We know how to kill, we know how to take life away, but at this point we don't know how to give it. So we see that some of these forms are very different, and they have a distinct character. Each mountain has a distinct character, but plants have the even more distinct character. Each one has its essential oils so that it smells different than the other, and it has different components and such like that. This is exactly what seers like the Rosicrucian seers have claimed for centuries, that beyond this physical world, there is a world that is a world of life. It's actually part of the physical world, because all of the ethers respond to the principles of the physical world, gravity. We have the experiment of Arthur Eddington, who proved that even light, as rare as it is bent by a gravitational field. Einstein gets too much credit, so we have to give all this time to Eddington. So what we're trying to say is that there are different kinds of beings living in this world with different forms, and that some of them are life, are alive, and they have some degree of autonomy. Now, there are some principles that are important to understanding all the worlds, even the desire world, which we will get to by the end of this talk. Every being that is in the cosmos is a focus of the one universal spirit. Some might not be waking, some might not be very conscious at all, but all beings are foci of the one universal spirit. Some, such as ourselves, are very fortunate to be wakingly self-conscious and to be consciously participating in this wonderful, wonderful act of creation. We're all serving the universal spirit. And we even provide experience for other, consciously or unwittingly, we're providing experience for others in the whole business. Now the various, with just our simple senses, without having any clairvoyance or higher spiritual vision or seership or anything like that, we see that some of the living forms around us are more facile and are more efficient in gaining experience. Their capability and their efficiency depends on how long they have been at it, how long they have been worked on so that they can wake up to what they are in. And in this, there is one general principle that is very important, and that is experience unfolds capability. Meaning to say, that when you have experienced something passively at first because you don't have any control, but the longer you have experienced something, the more you awaken the capacity to work with that which you have experienced. Without any experience in any given spiritual world, you can't have a vehicle of consciousness that relates to that world. It's a very simple Rosicrucian principle that applies to all schools of mysticism because it's about reality. The schools aren't important. They're only important in that you're more attuned to one than you are to another, just like some people look better in green and other people look better wearing red. But it's still the reality that counts and what helps you get to that reality that counts. The principle, as stated in the Rosicrucian philosophy, is that in order to be conscious of a realm, you must have a vehicle of consciousness that relates to that realm. And before you can have a vehicle of consciousness that relates to that realm, you have to have experienced it enough so that which was only potential, and there's infinite potential, there isn't infinite actual, but there's infinite potential, and we can become anything, but before we can awaken that potential that we can relate to a given world, a given state of reality that has purpose and that has ends, we have to have experienced it enough. Very important. Usually it turns out that the experience begins that we are worked on in that realm. Just the same way that we work now on minerals. The life that is awakening through the mineral kingdom is beginning to understand its nature by our working with it. Yes, there are projected atomic structures and crystalline structures and all of those kinds of things, but the minerals don't know that, and it's by our working with them that they understand how the universal principles are in that congealed potential that we call matter, that congealed ignorance of something new that has never been known before in the cosmos, is the way that, with that experience, is the way they come to have physicality. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, as in many other schools of mysticism, any general world or any general realm is called the macrocosm. But when we've experienced a realm long enough so that we can have a discrete vehicle of consciousness of that realm, a body, that is called the microcosm. Like our physical bodies are the microcosm of the mineral kingdom. They're subject to all the same, you know, the water boils and all the interactions that take place sometimes tens of thousands per second in our body, like the Krebs cycle, or is, what is it, 1/10,000th of a second, Bonnie? Oh. All right, we'll take a different, we'll put you on the spot with a different one. How many million red blood cells are we making per second here? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you'd be surprised. It's hundreds of millions of red blood cells are being made every second in this room. Our bodies are alive even though I'm putting everybody else to sleep. It's almost a game I play with myself sometimes. How many people can I put to sleep this time? The Bible tells us God is not a respecter of persons because the universal spirit is impersonal. Best love is impersonal. Things get awfully murky if you start putting personal feelings into love. So the impersonality of the universal spirit is seen in the macrocosmic worlds. The macrocosmic physical world, at least the part of it that is congealed here as the Earth, it has a personality, but it isn't like somebody that's pumping weights and saying, hey, look at this, I got a great physical world, you know, something like that. It's an impersonal kind of thing. And in that impersonality, it allows us to understand objectively what it is, so that we, in our subjective little experience, can realize what it is and work creatively with it. That doesn't mean that the universal spirit is insensitive, because the universal spirit is keenly sensitive to everything that's going on in these realms. It's a different kind of sensitivity than we have. We don't see the earth having nerves running through it or anything like that, but it's more a total kind of experience. But each of these macrocosmic realms has a distinct character. Everything in spirit, as a result of consequence, is character. Someone, you can always tell someone who has experienced much, who has loved much, and who has grown much in the strength of character that they have. I don't ask me to describe character because it's very, very difficult, but the consequence of the experience realized in spirit is character. And so even the macrocosmic realms that we are working through have character. They have distinct purpose. They have distinct function. But each realm is in its way very objectively and impersonally virgin. Without any bias, without any slant, there are certain objective lessons about reality that we learn. So, in a sort of ironic way, even though we are very much limited by the restraints of the dense physical world, when we are here and separated from the spirit, we have a tremendous amount of freedom here. I don't mean totally separated from the spirit, but we are here. It's in one way we're in quarantine, in another way we're on a creative, like, you know, art camp or something like that. We're free here to do whatever we want to do as much as we want. Again, the Rosicrucian philosophy, like any mystery school, teaches that all realms are alive. And in their life, everything serves a purpose of the universal spirit. Even the seemingly inert rocks around us have life. It may be only chemical life, but it has life. It's the subject of physics and physical chemistry, or the subject of the fire sermon by Buddha. Everything is alive with its resonant life inside of itself. It's all on fire. The becoming foci within the universal spirit that are in the mineral kingdom has obviously a very dim consciousness. Clairvoyant, who can associate consciousness with anything, says that it's like in a deep trance-like state. That is almost no waking to it at all. And it's worked on, not working in itself. Having only the very, very beginnings of individuation, only starting to work in the direction of selfhood, they do not have the resistance that an individual self has. So we find all the laws of nature, of chemistry and physics, you know, water always boils at the same temperature, at the same pressure. And there's great obedience, because in the mineral kingdom there isn't that kind of individualism that fights back or tries to, as Paul says, kick against the bricks. It isn't that way. Things are perfectly predictable in the mineral kingdom. Even though the consciousness of the mineral kingdom is very low, it still serves. there is nothing in the cosmos that does not serve. Very much like the ancient Chinese proverb says, anything that heaven can create, earth can find a use for. And for the Chinese, that means eating. They'll eat anything. They eat centipedes and things like that. Yum, yum, pass the centipedes. I can't handle that. What? Including chairs and tables. I'm not expressing a prejudice against them. In fact, I think that's one of the values of Chinese culture. Most people in the United States eat hamburgers and fries every meal, the same meal, and not only are those bad foods, but it's repeated bad food. And the person who has a diet with a lot of variety in it is much more likely to have a healthy diet. The service of the life that comes through the mineral kingdom is to provide stuff, stable stuff, for all of the other kingdoms. Just think, if the minerals weren't as, just take the solids, if they weren't as stable as they are, and if they weren't in their unconsciousness as refractory as they are, you know, plants would just flop down into a pool, into, you know, like form in this world we experience through stability. So that's the service that the minerals offer to us. The only difference between the bodies of a tree, for example, and of a human being is that because of our longer evolutionary experience in dealing with the physical state, our bodies are supple and very soft. You know, a tree is a woody thing. Most of the life in the tree is in leaves, but even there, it's still not a very developed state of relating to the external world. The wonderful thing about this is, it could be called the law of service, is that because the minerals serve us by their not being evolved and being in a state that doesn't change like the spiritual worlds are, that are alive and are perpetually changing so fast, they change so fast that they seem almost solid, so that we hear things like Christ locked or things of that nature. But because they serve us, they get served back. Every time the mineral kingdom goes through our body, it picks up from our consciousness. Every time we hammer gold into a very thin sheet, in that process of being worked on and being made into something beautiful or being understood, it picks up from our consciousness. Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that the plant kingdom, or the vegetable kingdom, including everything from trees to algae, was once more mineral-like. But that the state of the universe was very much different then, and its mineral-like condition was very different. But when it was mineral-like, it provided the stuff of form also. And after a long period of creative experience, the whole cosmos had gone into a cosmic rest. Everything dissolved, and everything that was experienced by every being was taken all together back into the universal spirit, and everybody gained, or every being or every focus gained from what others had experienced. And it's like Isaac Newton, or was it? No, that was Archimedes that woke up in the middle of the night and had a dream that he had an experience, and he came in his pajamas in a party that he had been to earlier saying, "I have found it, I found it." When we dream, when we sleep, we dream and we can focus unimpededly on the meaning of things. And so in a cosmic night, when minerals sleep on their experience of form, it dawns on the waking, becoming spirit, the focus, the self that is part of the universal spirit, it dawns on it that it could make forms that grow and that change. And this is literally what the plant-like experience is. And so there is in the evolution a staged creation, that one stage automatically leads to another. So that plant kingdom is the obvious outcome of the mineral state of having been shaped. Now, we can see that there's some bodies are obviously more adept at working with the material world than others. Like, for example, algae is soft and it's somewhat mobile in the water, but you certainly wouldn't compare an alga with something like, there's an owl, for example, in Oregon that hunts at night and it fishes and it sees fish beneath the surface of the water at night. Now that's a pretty advanced evolutionary state to be able to do things like that. So the life in the plant kingdom, which includes the algae and the trees, was once mineral-like, but that it got the lesson and it became plant-like. Now, the whole evolutionary creation is a reflective process, because the stability of the minerals has a lot to do with resistance to change. They're too stupid to know the change, you know, they're just like that. And that resistance to change provides stability for other beings, but it reflects into the deep spiritual consciousness. So that which is becoming in the spirit at the same time that the form is going through the different shapes and textures and qualities that are learned in minerality is the power of will, which is the spiritual opposite of resistance. So there is a tremendous spiritual development that comes from every kind of material development. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, we call that the divine spirit. It's the inseparable will that is, in a way, almost inseparable from the universal will. In fact, by the time you have the consciousness to completely function with the will of the divine spirit, you're so much in love with and so much unified with the universal spirit that you wouldn't think of being willful in the first place. Similarly, the experience of vitality and the experience of growing and mutating forms that we find in the vegetable kingdom reflects into the realms of spirit, and it becomes the life spirit. The different spiritual philosophies have different names, but the seers have seen the same things, even though they may have a different take on them. The experience is objective. In fact, this is the funny thing, that as much as material science likes to say that it is an objective science, there's not as much unity about the nature of things in material science as there is in mysticism. And mysticism comes from, you know, is at the basis of all different kinds of religious beliefs and from various different periods in history. The reality is the same. The life spirit is the spirit that expresses light in the same way that plants are receptive to light. And the life spirit is the pure imagination. Not any imaginings, but the capacity to imagine anything. Anything that it is informed in, that is informed into it by the will of the divine spirit, it can be conceived in the life spirit. So that, again, the physical experience is reflected into the spiritual. Obviously, the life spirit represents the spirit of ongoing life. And it represents the simplest, most universal conception of purpose. It's something so deep that at least I think in most people that I've ever met in life, it's something so profound that to say it sounds trite, but we all get baffled by it, and we say it, as trite as our understanding of it is, and we just encounter something that is so stupendously wonderful about our existence, we say, that's life, and that's our trite understanding of something that is profoundly, profoundly deep. We say in the Rosicrucian philosophy at this time in the evolutionary creation that the life spirit is reflectively projected into our etheric bodies in what material science would call vitalism. They sneer at us in their books. I haven't looked at a botany book or a biology book in the last 10 years, but the last time I did look, they sneered at us. Sometimes so we can see that beings that are becoming individuated beings have an increasingly supple and subtle physicality through all of the lower realms, the chemical, the etheric, and at the same time, the spirit is reaching deeper and deeper into matter. In between time, there's guidance by all kinds of spiritual beings until that takes place. It's like we're guiding the minerals, even taking a jackhammer to the street. We're working on the minerals and helping them, even if we're not very conscious of it. Now, the next step in this is obvious. After another cosmic night's worth of sleep and dreaming, in processing and experiencing it with a universal genius, everything that has been experienced, well, if we can make a form that grows, why not make a form that detaches and that it can go wherever it will? And that's the next obvious step. And so we find the animal kingdom, which is not rooted in the earth, but it's detached, and it can move around. And it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward, but it's one of those things that, this is how funny it is, how it's almost shameful. I had an intellectual concept primarily of mysticism for a long time. It was like I was nothing but a walking head or something like that. Had an intellectual conception. Oh, I understand the cosmic conception. The first time I read the cosmic conception, I was ready to take the final exam. I said, I know this. Let me. And one day I was walking along, and I saw a bird in the tree. Something that we see every day, and I said, oh my God. There's the bird, and there's the tree. They were so different. And, like you could sense the life of the two of them, and we're walking around in this kind of wisdom all the time, and we don't understand the long, how many millions of years of process it takes for something that had the potential of being divine, but was in a deep, unconscious, perhaps blissfully unconscious state, to come to the point that it could fly around and that it could nest in a tree. When suddenly you wake up to it, you say, wow, what else am I missing? So the spirit passes deeper and deeper into matter, and matter reaches more and more up into the spirit. Now what happens, significant things happen, even though in the animal, the spirit isn't yet fully incarnated in its vehicles. But just the experience of being autonomous, physically autonomous, separate, so that you can move around, it has to work out that way, and we see it working out that way in the animal kingdom all the time. We see that there are things outside and beyond us. That's the first part. And the second part is a logical conclusion. You might call it a spiritual psychology. If there are things beyond my personal microcosmic sphere of being, then at least physically, I'm not complete. I'm an incomplete being. You might say that with this kind of realization, even though it's a realization over millions of years, there is a vague kind of cosmic loneliness or a vague kind of incompletion. But it's not much different than somebody that drives somebody who becomes a magnate, a steel magnate or something like that. And then it begins to dawn on the being, if there are things beyond myself, I can relate to them. This has a real effect on us. So with this separation, there's a realization of incompletion. And with that incompletion, we focus our attention on things outside of us. Now, if we think of this of animal-like creatures or animals that we now see around us, they can move, and that completes the picture. The wanting part of the incorporate being, the part that causes us to seek things outside of us, is what we call desire. We desire to be complete in one way or another. The desire may express itself, as we're going to talk a lot about in succeeding nights this week. Some of the desires may be attractive and some of them may be repulsive, but there is always some motive consciousness toward an object of our attention that affects our separate, singular existence. In the mineral stages, we were worked on. In the plant-like stages, we were worked on. But the Bible and other spiritual books tell us that we are becoming gods. We are becoming creative beings within the one creative being. Therefore, it's important that as soon as possible that we become self-reliant creative beings, co-creators, to become givers. We've said that in the mineral-like state, our service was to provide stable forms. Plant-like state gives vitality. None of the beings that we see in the world around us can live without the vitality that comes from the plant kingdom. We have sacrificed our ability to produce our own etheric bodies strictly from sunlight alone in order that we could be sexually creative beings. At another stage, we get that all back. But right now, the service that the plant kingdom offers is life. Now, these services that are offered by the minerals and by the plants are pretty passive services. But when we think about the service that the animals provide, it's something that's much more active. That is, each animal, we've been talking about this, the afternoon talks are meant to be parallel to these evening talks. In the afternoon talks, we're talking about astrology, and we just said this afternoon that the circle zodiac means Zeus Keikel in Greek, which means wheel or circle of animals. And we looked this afternoon at the desire world as being the place where the intelligences are that guide the different animal species. But there is something about the nature of the animal-like state that its service represents that pure primal desire in its simplest way possible. The simplest kind of attraction and repulsion. For example, the fox says that rabbit is attractive to me, and the rabbit says that fox is repulsive to me. The simplest, most primal desire. But each species is based on a universal idea in the deep and the transcendent worlds, way beyond even concrete thinking. So that each species, each of the signs of the zodiac, Aquarius rules bears, and the temperament of bears is a carrying of a universal idea from one of 12 points of view into the world through that species, or through that family of species. So what we're talking about is the service of the animal kingdom is to provide simple, inspiring motivation. That's what the purpose of the desire world is. See, it took us only about 2 hours, but we got to the what we were trying to get to. It means that with desire, we can move ourselves to experience. A lot of that experience still requires guidance. And even us, we're self-conscious. That's why we're having these talks. Last year we talked about building the soul body, which is central to the Rosicrucian work, but the greatest impediment to building the soul body is our relationship to desire, because we have some very bad habits with desire. But we have the ability to motivate ourselves and to desire whatever we choose to desire. Whether it be something lofty like those feelings that can only be experienced in art, or whether it's something base that is some gross personal satisfaction or something like that. But even in us, with our self-consciousness, we need help because we really don't take care of our desire. Okay, let's go back, circle back, and come at something again. In the involutionary stages of the creative, evolutionary creation, the spirit becomes more and more involved in matter, and matter becomes more and more directed towards spirit. And what happens first in matter when we are worked on or are guided through our experience, that becomes spiritual development. All of the material worlds, even those that aren't made of chemical stuff or etheric stuff, even the desire world and the world of concrete thought, they have beginnings and ends. But even those are meant to be realms of experience in the spirit-matter pole that represent the two directions or two dimensions in space-time, which means something very different to mystics than it does to physicists. But in that whole activity that has a spiritual side and a material side to it, experience is brought to us so that we can become creative, that we can have the joy of experiencing the creative spirit and bringing that to actually ourself, because it is one universal spirit, even the parts that are unself-conscious that haven't even begun an evolution yet. So the animal-like existence must be processed also. So after another cosmic night, when a being has experienced an animal-like state, that experience of a separate body leads to the consciousness of a separate self, to the what in the Rosicrucian consciousness is called the human spirit. It's associated with ideational thinking, which is both universal but yet about things that can be made manifest physically or materially. And so we then have a threefold spirit, and we have a threefold body so far. We have a dense physical body for the experience of form and texture. We have an etheric body for experiencing life and vitality. And we have a desire body for expressing emotion, feeling, and most important, motivation. We call it the desire body because that is its function. It is to drive us so that we have experience. By reflection, the experience in form and in gross concrete matter and the resistance thereof awakens the capacity in spirit to will. The life and the vitality and the primal quality or the primary quality of the ability to take another shape awakens the life spirit, which is the vehicle of spiritual life, the vehicle of light and pure imagination, and the separate ability to be motivated and do things for oneself, not attached to the macrocosm, but as an autonomous free agent, reflects into becoming a self, a threefold spirit, which in ancient days used to be called the spiritual ego with a capital E, and not the ego that we hear from modern psychologists with a small e. All that is required is the concrete mind, because through the concrete mind, which is the lens, which is the focus, the spiritual being can come in and it can reside within its own creation. So that we, as spiritual beings, are capable of seeing ourselves objectively from a universal macrocosmic consciousness. We can see ourselves really as others see us, because that's really what getting out of the body means. It means not only just a physical activity of getting out of your physical body, it means you get to see yourself with the perspective of the cosmos. And if you have a true transcendental spiritual awakening, you can see your being as an individual down to the most minute part of your personality. But at the same time, we can see from within. This is a really unique position that we are in, and it's a very, very wonderful position that we are in. The personality has limits, and the spirit is universal, but the two work hand in hand. So, and the perfect thing about this is, since these vehicles are the exact expression of the spirit, they're tailor-made to us. They're, you know, if we don't like what our bodies are, we have nobody to blame but ourselves. And it gives us plenty of incentive, plenty of incentive. I've been thinking about things. I'm old enough now that I have aches and pains, and I'm keenly aware of a lot of physical limitations. And I'm saying to myself, never again. I'm not going to do these kinds. I'm not going to build a body like this again. I'm very happy with it. I'm very lucky to be as healthy as I have been. But all right, without going, this should have been over a long time ago already. But this is what the human state is. This is what we experience, and this is what our work is right now. There are going to be other stages that are going to be glorious, but it's like William Blake, the poet, says, to become a star, you must shine where you are. Meaning, forevermore, we start right here. So this is the answer that the mysteries, especially the Rosicrucian mysteries, give to the question of Shakespeare, what is a man? He said it in a sexist way. Or what Solomon said, what is man that you are mindful of him? So this is very brief, and it's very rough, but nonetheless, it's a hint of how beautifully clear this philosophy is. You know, like, what is our existence? I have a physical existence, and I'm vital. I can jump, I can run, I can dance, and I can emote, and I can think, and there is I that does that. And what is beyond I is almost unspeakable. So a human being is a spiritual being, a creative spiritual being. It's a distinct entity. It's a unique focus of the universal spirit that even the centralmost focus of that universal spirit, which we call God or the Almighty, even that must respect our unique point of view. We are beings that, because of our universality, we're capable of knowing anything in heaven or earth. We are truth knowers. It isn't a matter of chemistry. I can say whatever I want to say to you, and if we share a common truth, we know the truth of that. Persuasion helps, but it is the intuitive knowing of whether something is true or not that counts. So, we are spiritual beings that have different capacities, will, feeling and imagination, and thinking activity. But in our personal being, we are thinkers, we can produce definite concrete thoughts, we are emoters, and we are motivators, so that we can move by desire. We are vital so that we can have living forms, and we are physical with enough spirituality so that our physical forms are very, very live. Now, this answers to everything I've ever experienced in life, and this is why the mysteries are so true to me. And I see very intelligent people working with material science, and they devise really ingenious experiments to do this and that, and they can control things by genetic engineering and do all of these. You know that almost all things that are like mystical states, by zapping your brain in the right way, they can make you think that you've had a mystical experience? But these are really very clever, intelligent beings, but they don't have the answers. Like, this is what I experience, and this is what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about motivation, the part that it, how it functions in us, the principles of how it functions in us, what we can do with it, and eventually what will evolve out of it within our emotional nature. And we're going to be talking about our problems, including the very big problem with our desire nature and what we do with that. So what we're talking about is something like a flower. There are seeds, and the seed is very close to being like a stone. And if the seed is never germinated and the vitality doesn't enter into it, it'll never grow. But there's something more than just a plant with stems and leaves. There's the flower and there is the fruit. And the flower and the fruit are to the plant what desire is to us. It is our relationship to the world that has color. Any kind of experience of any human being, be it an artist or a musician or somebody that can feel all of those feelings and can objectify them and pass them to us, it's obviously that this is somebody that's really, really in bloom and that understands all of the finer potentials of things that we can do other than just a rabbit and a fox. All right, this is a little bit of an idea of what we're going to be talking about, and we'll go more deeply into it tomorrow, and it will be a little tedious from time to time, but I hope not too bad. Let's close with the Rosicrucian Students' Prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Oh, no, I forget what the anecdote was. What were we talking about when the anecdote came up? What? No, I was just humbugging. I'm utterly shameless. I don't have any secrets of any kind that I wouldn't tell anybody.
Okay, the antidotes.
If I remember it by the end of the week, I'll share that.